26. Although nothing else Erin did after the 6th of August 2023 would form part of the evidence against her, the police still had considerable work to do to strengthen their case. To give some examples, they had to make sure there was no possibility that sliced button mushrooms from Woolworths could include death caps. To all the millions of Australians who shop at Woolies, you can relax. It is impossible. All button mushrooms sold commercially are cultivated, and death cap mushrooms cannot be cultivated. But Steve and his team still needed to put in the time and legwork to prove that. The legendary Sunbeam Food Lab electronic dehydrator was in the lab at the Victoria Police Forensic Service Centre by the 10th of August. Forensic officer Sonia Geremia ran the fingerprint tests, and Georgia Kontopoulos and Ben Goodwin carefully picked crumbs and small vegetable remains from the vents and the insert trays. The fingerprints on the dehydrator were Erin's, and Dr. David Lovelock from Plant Health Australia took us through the highly technical process of DNA testing to prove that the crumbs collected from the dehydrator included crumbs from death cap mushrooms. All of this took weeks, but it's the level of proof needed in a modern murder trial. Dr. Shaman Fox Henry won my award for having the best name of any witness, and he was also on the podium in the competition for the face that best matched its owner's profession. Big black-rimmed glasses and a thick, sporty moustache seemed a bespoke fit for a senior digital forensics officer whose explanation of the dark art of data retrieval from computer systems spanned 3 days of the trial. He was doing all his work in the later months of 2023, but it uncovered some of the most important pieces of evidence, such as Erin's history of foraging and her vitriolic anger at Simon and his parents during December 2022. The police also needed as much detail as they could about Erin's movements from phone tracking, and that information is, likewise, mind-numbingly complicated and time-consuming to collate and interpret. It took weeks. But Matthew Sorrell, the Dumbledore of Australia, who pipped Shaman Fox Henry for the Face Matches the Profession Award, spoke with a clarity that did everything to inspire confidence in his results. He was also completely at ease walking the line between taking his job and the theatre of a murder trial seriously, while at the same time understanding that moments of breezy humour can still be welcome. Steve Eppingstall also needed statements from all the Patterson family, including Ian, when, in late September, he was finally well enough to provide one. He needed to prove when and where Erin had bought the dehydrator, and when and where she had bought all the ingredients for her beef Wellingtons. He had to establish that, on current medical knowledge, it takes only 8 milligrams of amanitotoxin, that's 8 millionths of a kilo, to kill an 80-kilo human being. It was a lot of work. Some of the electronic forensic work continued into 2024, but by November 2023, Steve and his team figured that they had enough. He might have then run the pillars of the case past Jane Warren or Sarah Lenthal at the DPP. For a matter of this gravity, that wouldn't surprise me. What do you reckon? He would have been saying. Have we got enough? Obviously, they decided that they did. At 8 a.m. on the 2nd of November 2023, they conducted another search of Erin's Gibson Street house. They picked up the laptops they had missed on the 5th of August and looked for anything else. Later that day, Erin was charged with 3 counts of murder and 4 counts of attempted murder. As we know, 3 of those attempted murder charges were dropped just before the trial started. We were only asked to find a verdict on the charges of the murder of Heather, Gail and Don, and the attempted murder of Ian. But we had a woman's fate in our hands. We had to be sure, beyond reasonable doubt. It took us 8 days. In the end, it wasn't a hard decision, but we still wanted to be careful. We started with some absolutes, things of prime relevance that were also beyond doubt and, or had, by now, been openly admitted. 1. Erin had foraged for wild mushrooms in nearby parks and trails. 2. She had dehydrated deathcap mushrooms in her dehydrator. 3. The mushroom mixture in her beef Wellingtons had included those dehydrated deathcap mushrooms. 4. The beef Wellingtons had killed 3 of her lunch guests and very nearly killed a 4th. The autopsies of Heather and Gail and the inspection of Don's liver prior to transplant had revealed that in all 3 cases, the ammonita toxins had killed their livers. 5. By contrast, Erin had not suffered any liver damage at all. Before we look at anything else, let's just put a pin in those 5 statements. The first 4 could be explained by a tragic accident or by a deliberate act with murderous intent. The 5th makes a tragic accident a less likely explanation and an act of murderous intent a more likely explanation. Keeping that in mind, let's go back to the lunch. Why did it happen? Erin said that she had wanted to discuss a medical issue and how to break the news of that issue to her children. Ian and Simon gave evidence to support this statement, and she had alluded to a cancer diagnosis in text messages with Gail prior to the lunch. Whatever her exact words were, just after the lunch, she had certainly led all 4 of them to believe that she had been diagnosed with cancer, and that was the medical issue she had wanted to discuss and the reason why she had invited her in-laws to lunch. By accessing Erin's own medical records and the Victorian Cancer Registry, however, Steve and his team could also prove that all Erin's talk of cancer was a lie, which Erin had to admit. She knew she didn't have cancer, and she hadn't even undergone the tests that she had mentioned to Gail. It was all a deliberate piece of deception and subterfuge. At the trial, and long after she was arrested, Erin claimed the real medical issue had been gastric bypass surgery. According to Erin, contemplating this surgery had been a last, desperate solution aimed at ending 20 years or so of bulimia, which she had been too ashamed and embarrassed to mention. That, she said, is why she had made up the lies about cancer. I knew about shame and embarrassment, and I also knew about secrecy. If you're in a relationship over that length of time, whether it's with a partner or with kids or both, it is very difficult to keep something like bulimia completely hidden. Abnormal patterns of behaviour need explaining. So do the frequency of showers. Mysterious cash withdrawals to cover food purchases when you said you were paying a parking ticket. That can become problematic. Bruises and cuts on your hand from sticking your fingers down your throat can trip you up. It just begins to look like you're covering something up. Because you are. Even if the people you are closest to have no idea what it is. When suspicions grow and the truth is never faced, it can kill a relationship. Tell me about it. But no 2 journeys through a thing like bulimia are the same. I had to respect that. Still, if Erin didn't want us to simply take her at her word, why didn't she put her dentist in the witness box? He or she would know. Dentists can tell very quickly, particularly if it's been going on for years, but that didn't happen. Obviously, no one in the Patterson family ever suspected anything, not a hint of it. And look at Erin's hands. I was looking at them in the witness box, smooth as a baby's, and you can see them in some of the earlier footage, at the doorstep press interview early on, and when she was handing her phone over to Luke Farrell. When I couldn't see any of the usual signs, well, yes, I was sceptical. And then there was the way she gave her evidence. When Colin had asked Erin what she was planning to do about her low self-esteem and weight issues, Erin said, "I was planning to have weight loss surgery, you know. Is it gastric bypass? I was planning to do that." She lost me right at that moment when she hesitated and then asked the question, "Is it gastric bypass?" If she had truly been driven to the end of her tether by a debilitating disease that she had never been able to control, and she had got to the point where she was seriously considering highly invasive surgery, she would have Googled the crap out of it. We have already seen what a proficient online researcher she was. She was quick and good. It would have been on her mind for weeks, possibly months. But she answered Colin with a hesitation and a rhetorical question that was so unnatural that it sealed the deal. Even if it was just a misguided attempt to appear nervous and vulnerable, it still didn't cut it, especially when we soon learned that the facility she had booked herself into to discuss gastric bypass surgery had never offered the procedure in the first place. We'd been told not to guess, but I wasn't guessing. It was just another lie. Erin had never been planning to have gastric bypass surgery. It might have been a small moment, but every one of us on that jury panel had a different one. For each of us, there was one moment, one piece of the jigsaw puzzle that clarified the whole picture once we found its place. When Justice Beale gave his directions to us at the very end of the trial, he had some careful things to say about lying. If you find that the accused lied about something, you can use that fact to help you decide whether or not you believe the other things the accused has said. That is not to say that just because you find that she lied about one matter, you must also find she has been lying about everything else. But you can use the fact that she lied to help you determine the truthfulness of other things that she has said. But, he continued, do not reason that just because a person is shown to have told a lie about something, she must be guilty. Evidence that she told these lies is not evidence of guilt. These alleged lies are only relevant, if at all, in assessing her credibility. Erin had lied about having cancer and lied about having bulimia and planning gastric bypass surgery. She'd lied about foraging. She'd lied about including foraged mushrooms in her beef Wellingtons, and she'd lied about owning a dehydrator. She'd even lied in her actions when she'd been asked to hand over her phone. Erin had no credibility left. Had she also lied about never going to Locke Memorial Reserve on the 28th of April? Had she lied about not being in Outram on the 22nd of May? Had she lied about adding dried mushrooms from an Asian grocer to her Wellingtons? Had she lied about having diarrhea on a 3-hour drive to Tyab and back? Had she lied about needing to pen her sheep and feed the dog before coming back to hospital after first hearing she might have eaten a deadly dose of toxic mushrooms? Justice Beale had given us some more advice. You should consider all of the evidence in the case and only draw reasonable conclusions based on the evidence that you accept. Well, none of us accepted that an innocent parent would feed their children leftovers from a lunch if that lunch had already made that parent sick and their lunch guest sick. So the only reasonable conclusion was that Erin knew the leftovers she gave her children the next day were not contaminated. And the only reasonable conclusion that followed from that is that she knew which beef Wellingtons were poisoned and which ones were not. If she knew that, then feeding her 4 guests contaminated Wellingtons and saving an uncontaminated one for herself could not have been a tragic accident. It was premeditated, deliberate, and intentional. Justice Beale's final advice returned to the instruction he had given us at the very beginning of the trial. You may only convict the accused of an offence if you are satisfied that her guilt of that offence is the only reasonable conclusion to be drawn from the whole of the evidence. We went over it several times. We were told to take our time. But the only reasonable conclusion we could draw from the whole of the evidence was that Erin had picked deathcap mushrooms in April and May of 2023, and she had dehydrated them and stored them. She had planned a lunch for no other purpose than to use those deathcap mushrooms, and she had then created a menu that allowed her to separate poison portions from safe portions. Everything else that followed was an attempt to hide, blur, or contradict those actions. And the only reasonable conclusion was that all those actions had been intentional. So yeah, as the world now knows, we found Erin Patterson guilty. Why did she do it? I had always thought I would not be able to say she was guilty unless I could answer that question. But I did, and I can't. I don't know what was going through Erin's mind. It is, I'm sure, part of the macabre fascination with the whole case. What was she thinking? Is she a narcissist, on the spectrum somewhere? Evil, mad, both, all of the above, something else entirely? You know as much as I do now. I've told you everything that was put before us in court about her behaviour, history, opinions, and attitudes towards friends and family over many years. But none of us jurors got to talk to her. That's certainly not allowed. I wish they would allow that. It'd be a courageous amendment to the Juries Act, but I'd love to make a case for it. Anyway, it didn't happen, and nor could we dig around to find other anecdotes about her from other people. All we had to go on was the evidence and testimony presented to us in court. Full stop. That's it. In the end, that was enough to convince us beyond reasonable doubt that she definitely did it. But far from enough to tell us why. I don't know. What do you think?